Hello, everyone. Welcome. My name is Ben Wilder, director of the Desert Laboratory on Tumamoc Hill with the University of Arizona. And thank you for taking the time to join us for this exciting lecture series. Like always, I am honored and so happy to be speaking to you from Tumamoc Hill, known in Ottom as Chimamagi-Duag, Horned Lizard Mountain, on the ancestral lands of the Sabaipri and Tana-Ottom peoples. This volcanic hill is of prominent ancestral, cultural, and sacred significance to the Ottom nations, including the Tana-Ottom Nation, Gila River Indian Community, the Salt River Pima-Maricopa Indian Community, the Akchin Indian Community, as well as the Hopi Tribe and the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe. The Desert Laboratory recognizes the cultural significance of Chumamoc as the bedrock of our institutions and our future actions. This lecture series, the Chumamoc Resilience Garden, Planting the Seeds for Tomorrow, is really about celebrating this new space that we're creating for our community, but digging into why are we creating this space and what are we trying to accomplish in doing so. We have five fantastic lectures. This is the second of which is really connecting you to the inspiration for this, as well as the people and the concepts that are the backbone of this new space that we're creating. The series is really to help you envision what we're creating, be it that you live here in Tucson or are far away, and that you can kind of go refer back to this series too down the road as we all collectively see and contribute to what the Tumamoc Resilience Garden will be in the years to come. The canvas for many of these concepts we talked about in our first contribution of this series, focused on Arid America by Dr. Aaron Reardon and Dr. Gary Nabhan. In this talk, we are really going to use that as a platform and take another perspective of that. And I love the title, and this is so inspired by Brad, which is Planting the Rain. And it is all about really providing the foundations. And what I mean by foundations is a system that will work and self-maintain itself on sound ecological and hydrological principles over time. And that's really what that foundation is, what we're trying to create here in this lecture, but also physically on the ground. So we are thrilled to have Brad Lancaster be a part of this project. For those of you that know his work, you know why, and for the rest of you, you soon will find out. Specifically, and I'm teasing Brad's words a little bit here, but he's really helped me conceptualize what we're trying to undertake in the space. Is he's helping us design a space that utilizes the best assets here of the hill and much of the water that comes off the slopes of Chumamoc, and channel that into basins where we're going to be planting a trinity of leguminous trees, ironwood, palo verde, and mesquite, that will then create an overstory of shade, or that nurse tree effect, such a profound ecological concept, as well as in practice, a key facilitation that happens throughout deserts of the world. And that, using that as this backbone to creating this shade, the space, the microclimates for this understory guilds of food plants. I won't go into it more. Brad will be able to explain much better than I in terms of how we're going to be creating that. So without further ado, let me introduce Brad and we'll get into the meat and the content of this lecture. So Brad Lancaster is the author of the award-winning Rainwater Harvesting for Drylands and Beyond, and co-founder of Neighborhood Foresters. Since 1993, Brad has run a successful permaculture education, design, and consultation business focused on integrated, regenerative approaches to landscape design, planning, and living. In the Sonoran Desert, with just 11 inches of average annual rainfall here in the Tucson region, he and his brother's family harvest about 100,000 gallons of rainwater a year on an eighth of an acre urban lot and adjoining right of way. This harvested water is then turned into living air conditioners or of food-bearing shade trees, abundant gardens, and a thriving landscape incorporating wildlife habitat, beauty, medicinal plants, and more. The goal of his book series and overall work is to empower his clients and community to make positive change in their own lives and neighborhoods by harvesting and enhancing free on-site resources such as water, sun, wind, shade, community, and more. It's catching on, as is evidenced by tens of thousands of practitioners and demand for Brad's work around the world. We're sure fortunate to have you part of this project, Brad. I have you join us now. And we can't wait to hear more about what you're creating with us. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much for the opportunity. All right, so I will share my screen and jump in. Yeah. All right. So I want to share with you today a number of ways by which we can plant the rain to grow thriving regenerative abundance. And to begin, I like to ask three questions. So the first, what is the story of this place where you live, work, and play? And when you're thinking of the story of this place, I want you to also be thinking and asking yourself, well, what's my role in that story? And if you're having any trouble of thinking about what the story is of this place, think about that which you love about this place. And when you think about that which you love, you can ask yourself another question. Are you collaborating with what you love about this place? So for me, the life indigenous to this place is a true inspiration and source of joy for me, as is the precious waters that enable this life. So when I am thinking about, well, what's my role in the story of this place? One thing I'm striving for is, how can I better collaborate with the life of this place? How can I perhaps give back more to these living systems than I take from them? So they'll be more available for more people long into the future and more species. So with that idea, and now you've got a sense of the lens from which I'm coming, let's jump into some of the ways that I strive to go about collaborating with this place and giving back more than I take in terms of water. So first off on this slide, I want to show you that idea of how we can increase the amount of available rainfall if first we keep it on site. So on the left part of this slide, we can see if we create a planting area that is basin-like shaped, sunken, it can then harvest and hold on to the direct rainfall. And we'll get the full amount of that rainfall. We won't be draining any away. But we can do even better if we turn runoff from adjoining hard surfaces, be it a roof, pavement, or soil. If we direct that adjoining runoff to the same planting area, we turn that runoff to run on, which is right on. And there we are harvesting both direct rainfall and the runoff. And we can increase the available rainfall by 2 times if the surface area of the adjoining hardscape is the same surface area as the planting area. If the adjoining hardscapes even more, we increase the available rainfall even more. So on the right-hand side of the slide, we've got 2 areas of adjoining hardscape, which each is the same surface area as the planting area. And by directing that runoff to this sunken planting area, we're able to triple the available rainfall. So this is super easy to do, particularly in our built environment, because so much of the built environment around us is paved or compacted. So there's huge potential. But the key is, we can't just direct the runoff from adjoining surfaces to the planting areas. The planting areas really do need to also be sunken so that they can hold on to both that rainfall and runoff turned run on and have time to infiltrate it. And to more quickly infiltrate that water, we need to grow a living sponge of topsoil and other life. So I want to show you a couple examples, one from Syria in the Middle East and in the upper left, and then the lower right from northern New Mexico. So these are different ways of attaining what I was showing off in the previous slide. So in the upper left, this is traditional dry land farming in Syria, just outside Aleppo, where at the Icarta Research Center, which has since moved since the troubles in Syria, but they plant on contour, and the crop you see in the lower right of the image is garbanzos and lentils. And they then, up above, have an area that is unplanted. And that unplanted area drains its runoff to the planting on contour, thereby increasing the amount of available rainfall for the crop. And they're able to then dry farm successfully, even in dry years, on their average of just over 12 inches of rain a year. Whereas in the lower right, instead of having an annual crop production, here we have perennial, with perennial native grasses that have been planted on contour, creating a living contour berm perpendicular to the flow of water that spreads out, slows down the water flow, allowing more of it to infiltrate, and carrying seed from the grass with it to revegetate downstream areas. So it's a real efficient way to revegetate an area. Instead of trying to revegetate a whole slope, you just revegetate a contour strip and let it self regenerate seed and moisture. In here in Tucson, at my brother and I's place, this photo on top shows what things were like when we purchased our property in 1994. Very little vegetation, and the bulk of the water was draining either off-site or, unfortunately, also into the house. So we flipped that. So instead of draining runoff to the street, we instead depressed the planting areas beside the street so they were lower than the street, and then directed the street runoff to the street side plantings. So in the after shot below, you see the result of now directing street runoff to street side plantings, and thereby irrigating street side plantings for free with the runoff from the street. And those plantings then grow to shade and cool the street while reducing flooding downstream too. And in that after photo, nothing was taller than a 5 gallon size plant when we planted it. We watered the first 3 years to get the plant established, and then ceased watering after that. So now all is irrigated solely by passively harvested rain and street runoff. So what we're practicing here, it's nothing new. It's just the context has changed. So there's many rich traditional practices of harvesting rain amongst the indigenous peoples throughout the world, where you have a dry climate, or at least a dry season. And on the left, we have an illustration of the Akchin runoff farming, whereby a debris dam was put in the arroyo to direct some of the stormwater flows up out of the arroyo channel and up onto the floodplain terrace. And then on the right, we have floodplain farming, where in the bigger flows, the water would just naturally spill over onto the floodplain and irrigate for free crops planted there. So what we are doing alongside the streets is the same thing. It's just that instead of a dry, sandy arroyo bed, we have a paved bed of asphalt. And instead of an earthen bank of an arroyo, we have a concrete bank of a street curb. So here you can see some of the effects in the storm of these street side basins. So in the upper left, there was an existing dip in the curb where there had once been a driveway. And we brought the basins to the dip in the curb. And that's how we began all this work back in the late 1990s, early 2000s. In the lower left is where there's a curb cut made specifically to let stormwater into a street side eddy basin. And then in the upper right, that's more creating a pool within the channel. So it's within the street, along the street gutter. So that fills up, and once filled, the surplus continues on down the street after grabbing a lot of that wonderful water. And in the bottom right, instead of a curb cut, we have a 4-inch diameter curb core to bring the water into the street side basin. So here is an illustration of the eddy basin. So there's different ways you can harvest water alongside a street. One of the ways I often prefer is the eddy basin. And why I call it an eddy basin is water will flow, let me get my cursor here, along and then hits the curb cut, which we make on the upslope side of the basin, fills up the basin. Once the water's filled, it backs up to the inlet point, and the surplus continues along the gutter as it had before this intervention, and then fills the next basin. And because water fills up, backs up within the basin, it doesn't carry organic mulch or other materials away. It's very self-maintaining and easy to use. And one of the amazing things is a lot of times here in the dryland environment of Tucson, we think we don't have much rain, but in fact, we have an incredible amount. In an average year of rainfall, more rain falls on the surface area of Tucson than its over 500,000 inhabitants consume of municipal water in a year. So we have more water than we need if we would harvest and hold on to it. We'll harvest it when it falls and hold on to it through the dry times to be available when we need it. And along the streets, it turns out the average residential street in Tucson drains 1 million gallons of runoff per mile per year. That's enough runoff to freely irrigate over 400 native food-bearing trees per mile, or one tree every 25 feet on both sides of the street. So every street in Tucson could be a passively shaded green belt irrigated with nothing more than the runoff from the street directed to street side plantings. But the key is, the only way that's going to work is if we create basins of sufficient size to capture and infiltrate that water. Okay. Now the basins themselves, this is inspired also by another traditional practice such as the waffle gardens. So by planting within basin shapes instead of on mound shapes, we harvest and retain the rain rather than draining the rain. Modifying that a bit with these perennial plantings alongside streets or in other water harvesting earthworks, I typically create 3 planting zones. So we've got, if you look at the upper left, the bottom zone, which receives the most water. And so we plant the most water tolerant and water needy species there. Then we have the terrace at mid elevation. And there we plant things that don't need as much water as those on the bottom and aren't as water tolerant as those on the bottom. But the great thing is the stuff that's planted on the terrace, their roots can still access the water on the bottom, but the root crown stays a little higher and drier. And then we have the top zone. That's where we plant the least water tolerant and water needy species. And I've worked with a number of local plant nurseries, such as Spadefoot Nursery. At Spadefoot Nursery, they now list a number of their plants by their preferred rain garden zone, making it easier for those that maybe aren't, that maybe don't yet have the knowledge of what species would prefer what microclimate. And if you're wondering how I figured this out, I just took a hike, many hikes. So we can just go out into the natural world and we can see in our pockets of intact Sonoran Desert ecosystem, what species of plants tend to grow in the low spots where they get more water and sediment. Those are good bottom species. What are right next to but not in the bottom, those are good terrace species. And what do we tend to find growing on our higher, drier spots? Hey, there's a species for your top zone. The encyclopedia is around us. Okay, and so the goal then is to create these plantings that are irrigated once established solely with free on-site waters, with rainwater and runoff being the primary waters. And it's good to be thinking of multiple strata. So we've got overstory of the trees, and then below that, we've got the larger shrubs and the vines growing up through, and below that, the shorter ground cover species. Below that, then the tuber-like species and whatnot in the fungal communities. So in our harsh, dry climate, if we can create more of that canopy, we then shade, cool, and shelter that which is below. So in our really hot, dry times, we've got a more protected microclimate below that can support a greater diversity of species and that can still thrive just on passively harvested waters. We don't have to be reliant on forever importing waters extracted from elsewhere. Okay, if we set all the systems up in a good way. And one of the easiest ways to succeed is by utilizing indigenous species to this place. The native plants that have adapted over millennia to both our climate, soils, and wildlife. So they're the best adapted to thrive here and support the life that is dependent on them that they collaborate with. So in the built environment, as people create landscapes, there seems to be a bit of a rock and gravel fetish of sorts, it seems to me, because if you look on the left, we oftentimes create this sea of gravel. And we're having to mine that rock and gravel elsewhere, oftentimes mining habitat, and then at great cost, transporting it to the site. And rather than mining a virgin material, such as a virgin mountain, to create our sites, why not instead use a waste material and turn it into a resource material? So rather than using rock or gravel, I prefer to use organic mulches. So when we create these water harvesting earthworks, these basin-like shapes, the great thing is, since everything moves with gravity, they capture leaf drop. And so it starts to self-generate its own organic mulch. If we do any prunings, we cut up and drop those prunings, further building the organic mulch, the spongy material that can more rapidly absorb the water. Because we don't want to have pooling water, pooling for more than 3 days, because then it becomes habitat for mosquitoes to go from egg to adult. Instead, the goal is to infiltrate the water as quickly as possible in the soil, so we lose less of it to evaporation, and we don't support mosquitoes. So great studies have been done by Mitch Pavo-Zuckerman and other researchers that have compared water harvesting basins that are mulched with a rock or a gravel to those mulched with an organic matter like leaf drop and cut up prunings. And they found that the water harvesting basins that are mulched with organic matter had twice as much soil moisture as the water harvesting basins that were mulched with rock or gravel. So that's huge. And because not only did it allow water to more quickly infiltrate, but that organic matter holds on to the moisture longer into the dry season. And we also found in the basins with mulch with organic matter, there's twice as much soil organic matter. Now you might be thinking, well, of course you have an organic matter mulch, it's got twice as much soil organic matter. But when I say soil organic matter, I don't just mean the leaf drop and whatnot. I also mean the life within the soil. There's far more life because that organic matter creates much more habitat for that life, which creates more burrows into the soil, which allows water to more quickly infiltrate, and which does a great job of bioremediating potential toxins, say from street runoff. Okay. Mulching is a great practice to enliven our soils. So in the upper left image, I'm showing a native soil in my neighborhood before we started creating water harvesting and plantings. And the second image on the upper right is showing we've now created a water harvesting basin. It's collected leaf drop and we're cutting up prunings and dropping those prunings within that basin. And then in the bottom right, you see the resulting soil. So we did not import any material. This is all organic matter that has been generated on site So we're not extracting resources from elsewhere. We're just better reinvesting the resources that are already freely at hand, creating a much more enlivened soil that's does a much better job of collaborating and enhancing our local hydrology. Now, along with surface mulch, we can also do vertical mulching. So vertical mulching is a practice used in dry lands throughout the world. I had originally learned of the practice through the book Dryland Gardens by David Cleveland and Daniela Soleri, where a number of African farmers had, they would take their sorghum, corn and corn stalks and millet stalks, and they would plant them vertically next to the next season's crop and within a water harvesting basin, similar to what I'm trying to illustrate here in the right-hand image, though here I've got a perennial tree as opposed to an annual crop. So you've already got the water harvesting basin collecting direct rainfall and runoff, and then you create this deeper hole within the basin packed full of coarse mulch, which rapidly absorbs the water. But the nice thing, it doesn't create any hazard that someone could fall into because it can take your full body weight. As my nephew shows in the lower left corner, he is standing on a vertical mulch. So within that street side water harvesting basin, we dug an additional 2 feet down, packed it full of coarse prunings, and he is standing on that. And it's working fantastic. Not just for holding water, but supporting a much more vibrant, beneficial fungi community or beneficial mycorrhizal community within the soil. Here's a juicy story about that. The more beneficial fungi, like mycorrhizal fungi, we have, the hair-like roots of the fungi fuse with the roots of the photosynthesizing vegetation, and thereby expanding the surface area of the roots of those life forms. So all are able to uptake more of the harvested moisture and cycle it. And the photosynthesizing plants give the mycorrhizal fungi sugars, and the fungi in return gives water and minerals. Pretty nice collaboration. So we want to work with those kind of collaborative lives. Now here I'm showing you how one can harvest water off a dirt road. This is in the Altar Valley. The Altar Valley Conservation Alliance has been doing some great work. This shows before a water harvesting intervention, where we've typically, when you've got dirt roads on a ranch or farm, that is the biggest maintenance cost because there's nothing stabilizing the road. So it's prone to erosion and it tends to be lower than the surrounding landscape. So it captures more of the runoff flow, which then flows down the road, creating a new waterway, dehydrating slopes. Eroding out the road. So you may have a drain, as is the case here on the left, but water still flows down the wheel ruts because water will take the path of least resistance. So a mentor of mine, Bill Zeedike, has created a strategy that addresses this and enhances the situation. It's called the rolling dip. So Bill Zeedike is the gentleman with the white beard and the hat in the middle of the photo. He is standing within the drain. So the idea is you have a drain, as you did in the previous slide, but this, it's not so deep. It's shallower and much wider. So you start to spread the flow of water over more surface area rather than channelizing it into a narrower area. And then a berm is created on the downslope side of the dip or the drain in the road. So there's no way water can continue to flow down the road. Then a key thing is you select where you're going to drain the road, where the natural landform can most readily spread out the flow to more area rather than concentrate it and create a head cut. So here, this photo is showing waist-high native grasses in southwestern Arizona, irrigated by the runoff from captured off that dirt road via the rolling dip. Fantastic to have waist-high native grasses here. So this is fantastic for both the wildlife and the livestock on the ranch. So with all our water harvesting strategies, we always want to have an overflow because there's going to be a storm event that's going to exceed the capacity of our system at some point. But we also always want to use that overflow flow and direct it in such a way that it's generating still more resources, opportunities, and potential. So if you've got a rainwater tank, don't just unconsciously direct overflow to a spot where it might erode under the tank or your house. Instead, direct the overflow to another tank or to an earthwork that can grow a tree to shade and cool the tank. And then send the overflow from that to another earthwork and another work. So you're slowing, spreading, infiltrating the water, cycling the water as much as possible before it leaves. So we want to shift from dysfunctional drains, which is what we have in the upper left, to more very functional and effective living sponges in the lower right. And by doing so, we can lengthen our ephemeral surface water flows, and we can bring back perennial surface flows. The key is that we have to get back to a place where natural recharge exceeds our extraction of groundwater so that we can start refilling the bank, refilling the tank, and the surface flow then is the point at which the overflow surfaces. All of this is, let's go to a bigger macro scale, let's go to a planetary scale, is striving to work with the soil carbon sponge to better mitigate climate extremes and also climate change on this planet. So what this illustration shows is we've got two scenarios. The one on the left is what I do not advocate, and the one on the right is what I do advocate. So the one on the left, when we have bare compacted soil, or worse, asphalt or so forth, the incoming heat and energy from the sun is reflected as radiant heat back up. And if we have pollution in the air, it's reflected back off that, back to the surface. And it's kind of like the accordion effect. So leading to more global warming. If that bare surface is not shaped in such a way that it can hold on to the rain, there's much less life it can support to start to buffer and shelter that harsh microclimate. Whereas on the right, we have the incoming radiation from the sun. Instead of hitting bare earth or pavement, it hits vegetation. So immediately the temperature is mitigated and reduced by the shading of that vegetation, by its diffuse surface area, and also by the evapotranspiration through the plant material. So the incoming energy from the sun is is basically absorbed and consumed. That radiant heat is consumed to turn a liquid water into a vapor via evaporation and evapotranspiration, further cooling the temperatures and generating more vegetation and life and supporting that. And the awesome thing is, maybe you all have heard of cloud seeding, where salts or whatnot are used to try and seed clouds to get them to rain. Well, it turns out there's no better cloud seeding than beneficial bacteria that live in the stomata of plants' leaves and which are carried up high into the atmosphere. So we got to have that vegetation for those ideal cloud seeds too. And then when we get the clouds, they also further reflect some of that incoming radiant heat energy of the sun. So anyhow, to try and sum this up, basically, don't drain the rain, retain the rain, plant and reinvest that rain so that we are collaborating with the living systems that have enabled life on this planet to begin with and create a more sheltered climate for us all. So we can go beyond just cycling and harvesting rainfall and runoff. We can also look to our lightly used water, like our household gray water. Instead of sending that right out of the system to the sewer, we can reuse it again and again to grow more on-site resources. And if we've already created our water harvesting basins for the rain and the runoff, those same earthworks, those same passive water harvesting earthworks are all ready to receive household gray water, air conditioning condensate, evaporative cooler bleed off, okay? So with gray water harvesting, this is one schematic of how one might be able to do that from a bathtub shower in the house. So you would direct the water from the bathtub via the drain, just as it's already doing, but then you'd have a three-way valve that can be located inside or outside the home that allows you to direct the water either to the sewer or the landscape. Here we've got it going to the landscape where it enters level-bottomed organic matter mulch basins planted with both perennial and annual vegetation. And that vegetation and other soil life becomes the living filter that filters out whatever contaminants there might be. And then the living pumps of vegetation enable you to access that water in the form of fruit, shelter, beauty, and more. To reiterate again, do not drain the rain and other free on-site waters. Instead, plant the rain and other free on-site waters to grow more regenerative abundance. Here in Tucson, the vast bulk of the water we receive through the municipal system is imported at great cost from the Colorado River, pumped uphill over 3,000 feet and 300 miles from river to Tucson. Instead of being reliant on that, we could instead do a much better job of what we already have freely at hand. Okay, so here we've got the water harvesting plan for the Tumac Garden. So on the left side of the image, the two parallel lines represent the road going up the hill, and then we've got the house with the shrine on its northern wall, just to the right or to the east of that road. Currently to the right of that is a barren lot, since a structure that was once there has been removed. So what we are proposing is to create a series of sunken water harvesting planting areas that will be receiving direct rainfall and some runoff coming off the hill via the drainage ditch running along the paved road. So in the lower left side of the image, there's the boathouse, and just due east of that, there is currently an old culvert, steel culvert or pipe that runs under the road that takes stormwater that is flowing north along the west side of the road. It's been clogged for years, but the plan is to unclog that to allow the water to go to the east side of the road. And then we will divert with a trinchera-like structure the water north into the gardens. So here is the culvert. Here is the trinchera-like diversion berm. So the flow would be directed into the gardens. At this point, under the existing overhead utility lines, this is where it enters the garden area. So it would parallel the circular drive around the existing structure and enter the first basin. Once that's filled, it would spill over a raised pathway to the next basin. Once that fills, it will spill over a raised pathway. It will spill to a third basin. Once that's filled, it will go one of two ways depending on what we assess when doing the build out. It could either overflow, or if we can get the elevations right, we will overflow it to the next basin. That will all be determined in March when we are planning to do the earthwork creation. Now on the northern part of the site, the entrance will be here for the people. But there is another drainage ditch that goes under the entrance via a culvert pipe again. Here we'll capture that water with a boomerang berm. It's kind of like a J-shaped berm. So water will collect in the basin here, then spill over, be caught in the next basin. Once filled, spills over, is then caught in the next. Overflows, spills to the next, and when that overflows, it will go under the canopy of the existing big mesquite tree with the bench there, flow through an existing channel, but we will be slightly altering that flow. Currently, the water flows out down a very steep eroding slope. We will instead direct that into this basin, which will overflow into this basin, which is now on the eastern end of the garden area. There's a raised pathway here. And on the very east, there's a raised earthen berm that will protect the very, that will protect the very steep slope on the east, the eroding slope, because it will keep water from pouring over it. And instead, we will direct the water to a much more gradual slope. Will be less erosion and we'll stabilize it with a rock mulch rundown. Once the water goes there, it can flow back to the original course, but via a much less erodible route. So the goal of this plan is to first harvest direct rainfall and stop losing it. Currently, without earthworks, in a good rainstorm, the bulk of the rain runs off the site. This is going to retain the rain that falls on site. And it's going to augment that further with some of the runoff flowing along the paved road by doing a capture and redirect into the gardens. We'll be increasing the amount of available rainfall even more. Another key aspect about the plan is to then create a living canopy of trees that will shelter a diverse understory of plantings below. So this is one of the draft tree canopy plans for the gardens. So you can see the basins are delineated in by brown lines, and then the darker green marks existing vegetation that's already there, trees and shrubs. And then the more lime green is where we are proposing to plant additional native food-bearing trees under which the understory plantings will be placed. And ideally, once this vegetation is established, usually takes 1 to 3 years, depending on the size of the plantings, to get them established. Once they're established with this water harvesting system, we'll be able to sustain them just on the passively harvested water. Unless there's an extreme drought year, then they can be supplementary irrigated. That's one of the goals anyway. So, and if any of you are having a hard time conceptualizing this, let me show you one slide of the Milagro co-housing project here in Tucson that used a similar approach. However, instead of earthen paths, they had raised concrete walkways between the basins. So this is the site right after the water harvesting basins were completed, and they are separated by a raised concrete walkway. And so this can capture direct rainfall, the runoff from the walkway, and the runoff from the adjoining roofs. So had it been left this way, it would have been a problem because we just would have had puddling water. And they have high clay soils there, so the water would be pooling longer than one would want. So we had to get the living sponge in place. So it was mulched with organic matter. It was seeded with indigenous wildflowers and also planted with predominantly native plants, but some non-native as well. And so it is now, in this lower left image, irrigated. Once established, it was irrigated. It can now be irrigated solely with passively harvested rainwater and recycled on-site wastewater, turned resource water from the household drains. And in the lower right is what it looks like 10 years after planting and establishment. Now the vegetation is so thick and dense, you can't look down the whole development. It's and the bird life is wonderful, wonderfully abundant and diverse. There's lots of produce being grown that the residents harvest. It's a true regenerative oasis. And if y'all would like more information, more specifics on a lot of these concepts and strategies, I can't recommend my books enough. You can get them direct from me at deep discount via my website, harvestingrainwater.com. Make sure you get the full, fully revised, full color editions. That's what I sell on the website. And you can also get information at neighborhoodforesters.org about a number of neighborhood efforts doing this work alongside neighborhood streets and on neighborhood properties to grow rain-irrigated native plant food forests throughout Tucson that help reinvest and recycle our local waters to regenerate the local hydrology. And of course, keep checking out the progress at the Tumac Gardens Project. All right, fantastic. So I'm going to stop sharing the screen.
Hold yours, if you don't mind, hold it. My first question is regarding an image that you showed. But first, thank you so much for that. And Brad, one of the things I love so much about your work is how practical it is. This makes sense. It's doable. It's in front of us. The encyclopedias around us, as you said, I love that. And we just need to read it and implement. So very cool. If you don't mind, can you transition back to the rainwater harvesting plan for our garden space on the hill? Perfect. So you mentioned one thing here that I want to draw attention to and then ask you a question. So if you don't mind highlighting where the current gate is. So for those that walk the hill frequently, that's where the current gate is that's often closed. The shrine is just to the south of that, you'll see. What we're doing with this space, and it's going to be a big change for people, but we hope you like it, is that we're going to be shifting the gate south and putting it parallel with the shrine house there, if you don't mind showing us there, Brad. Perfect. And so essentially what we're going to be doing is deflecting all foot traffic through the garden space and bringing everyone that visits the hill walking up or down through that curved path, that raised path, in and out. It's not going to be a huge detour. You all can still make excellent time walking up and down the hill, but we invite you to experience this garden more directly. Brad, my question for you is, and this can be apply here to the garden space we're creating on Tumamoc, but also throughout the city or in people's backyard, what would you invite people to pay attention to on their frequent visits to the hill, walking through the space? And one of the things I'm so excited about is we're going to have the opportunity to see this landscape change through time. What would you invite people to start to focus on or pay attention to and see change? Where should we look to see these changes and how can we interpret those changes over time?
Yeah. So right off the bat, right now, if you guys go out before the earthworks begin in March, go out and check out the landform so that you will be able to see how the landform is changed with these simple interventions. And then ideally you'll come back during a rainstorm and you'll see what happens. You'll watch that flow of the water and you'll see how it's retained rather than drained. But the other thing that's key is I want you to watch how bare earth becomes more obvious living earth, because water is the lubricant of exchange for all life. You can't have sex without water. You can't have growth without water. Better hydrating the site with the waters that are already freely at hand, you're going to see seed germinate much more readily. You're going to see the vegetation that's planted grow more vibrantly. So watch that. But then, and I'm going to come back to things you're going to see changing here. But as you then start walking up the hill, I want you to look for what are the inspirations for this whole design. So where do you see water linger in the intact pockets of our ecosystem as you walk up the hill? Where is there more organic matter? Where has it gathered? And what allowed that? Was it a depression in the earth? Was it some rocks or a branch on contour? What were the speed humps in the gravitationally pulled flow that allowed stuff to settle out and create a more fertile, organic matter rich, wetter sponge? See how we are trying to jumpstart that process. And then I also want you to look as you're walking up and down the hill. You are walking through a native food forest. So the trees indigenous to the hill, they produce an abundance of food. The mesquite with its edible pods. You can also make teas and whatnot from the flowers. So the sap is a wonderful desert candy, and it's a great cough drop. The desert ironwood has edible flowers and seed. The Palo Verde's edible flowers and seed. So, and it's not just edible for us, it's also for the abundant wildlife. So then see what species readily grow and thrive in the protected, under the protection of the overstory of these trees. And also look for taller shrubs, which I like to call bush trees. What grows under the protection of those? And then you can be inspired and informed by those species of, hey, what trees might I be able to plant in my garden under which I could plant more plantings? And what would work well under those? Well, you get the model is already out there. What the Tumamoc Garden is going to do is not only showcase and highlight those relationships here in the Tucson Basin, but also some species that you find a little further afield in northern Sonora, in northern Mexico, for example.
Let me pause you there, Brad. Yeah, and if you don't mind, you can end the share. I want to pick up on that topic you just said. So we've been having a lot of back and forth conversations as we're designing the garden space. And one of them is, what is our plant species palette? Are we just focusing on native species that occur on the footprint of the hill? Or exactly, are we incorporating extra local desert species that with various ranges out? And I think it's just a very fascinating conversation in terms of where we settled on that, which is give a brief synopsis of that, and I would love your feedback here, which is that we're in an era of climate change rapidly, where species are shifting their boundaries in real time. We know that's part of a long gradient of species migrations through time, especially post-Pleistocene 6,000 years ago, when the desert, as we see here in our region today, got established. And now the time scale just accelerated. So species are shifting their boundaries. And if we are just arbitrarily limiting ourselves to the plant palette of the hill today, we're not necessarily being realistic of where things are going in the future. So I think we're definitely thinking of the species of our region and thinking of climate-ready species for the future climate of our region. And I don't know, maybe Brad, you can pick up there in terms of, you know, in this project and others, how you're thinking of creating that space for species that may be shifting their boundaries in real time in the next years to decades.
Yeah. So the first thing is to create a very welcoming and inviting microclimate where they're going to have a better chance of thrival rather than just survival. By first creating these earth forms that are going to hold more of the rain when it falls, and also the organic matter and nutrients. Then the tree canopy, looking for that to be predominantly of the trees already native to Tumamoc Hill. They've proven the best adapted at this point in time, and also help, I think, bring people's attention to, hey, these aren't species you just go out to the desert to enjoy and have in your life. You can bring them into your home. So to really have a daily interaction and relationship with these species. And then with the understory plantings being a combination of what's currently indigenous to the hill and species that are, say, a little further south, we can kind of think for those species that are from a little further south, let's think of us maybe as the coyotes and collecting seed as we are moving up from Mexico up into the Tucson area. That seed is in our fur and it drops out on the site. So we're one of the species of this place, helping with the migration of the seed and life, and striving to do so in a way where we are exposing ourselves to these plants, the various uses over time through the many peoples of this area, and trying to learn more of the ecology and how we can do all this in a collaborative manner, rather than an extractive one, by consciously striving to have a reciprocal relationship with it.
And learning from the process along the way. Just so much what you described there is just, we're all part of this large natural experiment in these basins or these garden spaces that we are creating, that many of you are watching or creating, are our laboratories as well, and a great opportunity to learn from as they grow and change through time. Another discussion we've been having, Brad, that I think is really interesting and a practical one, and it relates because the goal of the Tumamoc Resilience Garden is to make a space that is replicable at multiple scales, but especially at the scale of your backyard or your neighborhood. And so it's really, we're hoping it to be an inspirational space. And one thing we've been talking a lot about right now, vis-a-vis the trees, is how much do we jumpstart the canopy coverage in terms of the size of trees we plant, but then what are the implications of that vis-a-vis how much irrigation we may need to bring to them, or the size of the hole we bring, and how much do we let them establish their own roots, or do we bring in specimen trees to create this canopy from day one, but then what are the implications of that? And I just think it's a really fascinating conversation that's a really practical one that anyone who's undertaking this work is going to have. And if you don't mind just sharing some insights in terms of a little bit of the trade-offs between time and immediate shade.
Yeah. So the cheapest way one can plant a canopy, but not the quickest, is to plant a seed where you want that plant to grow and live within a water harvesting earthwork, and to plant it at the beginning of the rainy season. So in a typical year, you will be able to plant that seed, walk away, and never have to water it, because it will grow in accordance to the available moisture. If we have an extreme drought year, you could bring in some supplemental water for that seedling through the first year. But typically with the water harvesting earthworks, you wouldn't need to do that. But it's going to take a while for that seedling to get up to a canopy size. So, we're wanting stuff to happen faster. So one could plant, say, a 5 or 15 gallon plant from a nursery. And that way, right off from the get-go, you've got whatever size that plant is at the time of planting. The one drawback is say like our velvet mesquite, you will not get the taproot. So when we're planting from potted plants, the taproot's already starting to spiral around in the pot. So we'll never get that amazing depth of taproot growing 65 feet, whatever deep, that we would from seed, because in the planting pot, you have that impediment of the pot, which disrupts that. Okay. But we're getting more verticality quicker. Now, an interesting thing is within 3 to 5 years, a 5-gallon tree will catch up and surpass the size of a 15-gallon tree. But that first 3 years, the 15 gallons looking bigger, feeling bigger, is bigger. Then we can, and typically it'll be a 1 to 3 year establishment period of irrigating, supplementarily irrigating that 5 or 15 gallon tree to get it established within a water harvesting earthwork. We can then come in with bigger species, bigger size trees, like say a 25 gallon, 36 gallon, or even bigger 24 inch box or 36 inch box tree. Now those box trees, as opposed to being grown from seed, they're typically grown out in a field, agricultural field, and then a machine comes in and severs the roots, boxes it up, and you have to keep irrigating at that time because it's under stress, and then plant it. So those boxed specimens, it's typical that you're going to have to water for at least 10 years, wow, supplementary water before it gets established, because you've got this big canopy above ground, and the root system, which should mimic or be larger than the above ground canopy, has now been reduced to a fraction of what it originally was and should be at that size specimen. So it's under stress. You have to irrigate much more and for a longer period of time until that root network can regrow.
When you say irrigate, you're talking about in addition to the passive rainwater harvesting that's entering from storm runoff.
Yeah, correct. Thanks for clarifying that. Yeah, because you're not wanting it to be, you're wanting to reduce that stress. So whereas a plant that's grown from seed in place, it's got a bigger root network. It's connected with the mycorrhizal fungi already within the soil. Yep. It has more of a buffering system in place when the stressors of drought come. Whereas those transplants don't have as many buffers in the initial years.
Yeah. And I would just say, I think one of the places we're settling on for the garden space on the hill is a kind of a multiple approach. And so that we all can both see, but also learn from the different stages we're starting things. And again, it'd be an iterative process and to kind of see what develops and then to learn in real time, in real space, from that trade-off.
And so you all, as you walk through, as it's developed, as it grows, you'll be able to see the larger specimens brought in to get some size and form right from the get-go. But you'll also be able to see areas that are planted with smaller specimens initially, and smaller still specimens, and even those grown in situ from seed. So you'll be able to see all this, the strata there, and how it works over time. And in terms of your own home or location, depending on your resources, needs, potentials, and challenges of that site, you can pick amongst that array for what's appropriate to your site.
Exactly. Well, Brad, I have so many more questions, but I think for time's sake, we'll probably leave it there for now. But I mean, I know I'm going to see you down there on the site. If you are all watching this in the spring of 2022, And we're releasing this in February. In March, we're going to be, as you said, Brad, breaking the ground, creating the basins. We're going to have lots of opportunities for workshops and on-site demonstrations and conversations in the space, which we welcome you all to join us for. We'll be announcing those as they're developed. And well, anyway, thank you for both your inspiration at the large scale in terms of the work that you're inspiring, you know, region-wide, and very micro at this space, which again, we hope scales out region-wide and beyond. So it's a pleasure to work with you. And thanks for sharing your time and knowledge.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much. I've been loving working on this and enjoying, looking forward to seeing it continue to progress.
Yeah, me too. And thank you everyone for joining us. Remember, you can find these lectures on our website, tumamoc.arizona.edu. Watch for them via YouTube or as a podcast platform via SoundCloud. We'll talk to you next month. And thank you very much. Be well, everyone.